And welcome to another edition of the Odyssey Radio Show. I'm your host, Mike Schultz. We talk about ancient mysteries and all sorts of interesting metaphysical topics. And tonight we're going to really dig into the topic of Lemuria. There's always so much talk about Atlantis and all of the people who reincarnated and used to live in Atlantis and all of these legends, but we never hear too much about Lemuria. So we're going to shift over from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean tonight. And I've invited on Frank Joseph. He is the author of a dozen books, and his latest is titled The Lost Civilization of Lemuria. Welcome to Odyssey, Frank Joseph.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, this is really exciting. Let's just dive in. I read your book. It's great. And I think the story for you kind of starts where you're talking to this government official in Malaysia, and she starts talking to you about this legend and this flood destroying a large island in the Pacific. Why don't you start there?
Well, it was all news to me. Yes, she was a representative of the Malaysian government, and she had a high-ranking position in the national educational system there. And she told me in the process of just a normal conversation about the origins of Malaysia. It's a story, it's a legend that every child knows. And the story was that the origins of the Malaysian people were on a former splendid kingdom in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And this kingdom had risen to very high levels of cultural and technological greatness. And then over a course of a series of natural catastrophes and cataclysms, this land began to sink beneath the sea. And as a consequence, the people evacuated this land. And as this land sank...
Frank, are you there? Okay, we're back on Odyssey. Sorry about that technical glitch. I'm going to ask Frank Joseph, our guest, we're talking about Lemuria tonight, to take it from the top. You said you were talking to a government official, and she told you about a flood and a mythical lost island. Can you tell us about that?
It wasn't so much a flood, actually. She repeated to me a story that was known, that is known throughout Malaysia. It's known to school children as well as just people in general, and that is the origins of the Malaysian people. Originated on, according to this legend, a massive island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, in which they achieved great cultural and technological splendor over time, and that a series of catastrophes, natural disasters, overwhelmed this central island. And as the island began to be overwhelmed by the sea, these residents of this island escaped. And as this island sank beneath the sea, so the story goes, the new landmass of what was later to become Malaysia rose, and that the survivors of this catastrophe populated this area, and they are considered the forefathers or the ancestors of the Malaysian people today. So that sort of started me wondering, like, that sounds like some stories that I heard about Mu or Lemuria, and that led me on quite a quest.
Absolutely. That was your original inspiration. Now let's talk about a curious monument near Malaysia. It's called Nan Madal, and it's a series of 92 artificial islands. Why don't you kind of take us there visually, explain or describe these strange islands, and give us the theory on what you think they were built for.
Nan Madal is one of the great wonders of the world, and it is hardly known outside of a few investigators because it is so remote, so difficult to get to. It's something like 2,800 miles south of Japan, to give you an idea how far away it is. The nearest landfall is almost 1,000 miles away. It's a very small little island in the Carolines. This is in the eastern Pacific Ocean, to set the stage for this site. And Nan Madal, actually, there's an island there called Pohnpei. And the people on Pohnpei have a rather low level of material culture, not much to speak of, corrugated roofed village, that's about all. But just off of the northern end of this small island called Pohnpei, there is an artificial island that was built thousands of years ago on top of a coral reef. The island itself is built in the water, and it is referred to as Nan Madal by the residents of Pohnpei. Nan Madal means the spaces in between, and this refers to a series of canals, gigantic canals, that formed together about 92 or 99, nobody's exactly sure, how many artificial islets, little islands. Therefore, it's referred to by people who've been there as the Venice of the Pacific. And it is an incredible city. It is unlike any other city in the world. It's made up of 280 billion pounds of magnetized basalt. It is a city that has no streets, just canals. It has massive buildings, but the buildings have no doors, and they have no windows. There is no evidence of writing or decoration of any kind. And yet this structure, which is a series of structures, goes back many thousands of years. And it represents a technology that was built by an unknown people in the deep past. And in my book, In the Lost Civilization of Lemuria, I try to show the reasons why this very peculiar place was created. And I believe, as incredible as this may seem, is that this site called Nan Madol in the middle of nowhere was built as a weather control station, that the people who operated this incredible location were in possession of technological greatness that we're only able to appreciate today. Actually, is beyond anything that we've made so far. We hear in the news sometimes about weather control attempts like HARP and so forth and GRETA. But, and Gwen, these are all anagrams for weather control modification experiments that are going on today. But someone, thousands of years ago, possessed what I believe was a device, a large device of this magnetized basalt. Archaeologists, by the way, have no clue where this incredible tonnage of magnetized basalt came from. The buildings on Nan Madol themselves are made of enormous girders, as it were. Some of these girders of basalt weigh as much as 20 tons, and they were lifted over 40 feet in the air to create these massive towers. No one knows who could have possibly made such an incredible construction feat so long ago. But its position...
You would have had to use a boat, right, to get these blocks to the Nan Madol?
Not a boat. They would have had to have some incredible raft, which is beyond the capabilities of anybody that's ever lived on Pohnpei or anywhere throughout the Carolinas. There was an experiment carried out by archaeologists not too long ago in which they tried to recreate the rafting of one of these boulders into place. What they did, they couldn't possibly lift a 20-ton boulder, one of the larger ones, so they settled for one of the smaller ones that weighed about 3/4 of a ton only. And those are the very small boulders or stones that have gone into the construction of Nan Madol, and they couldn't do it using these rafts that would have been built by people that were the natives of Pohnpei. So whoever built these tremendous towers and walls and jetties and harbors that go into Nan Madol on top of a coral reef on top of it, no one knows the technology. On top of that, whoever built Nan Madol also built underwater tunnels, which have been investigated by archaeologists from the University of Oregon and mapped. These are tunnels that go actually from the top of Nan Madol directly through the coral reef, something like about 18 feet beneath the surface of the Pacific Ocean. It's an incredible achievement. Very few people know about it. And if for nothing else, I was really glad to write The Lost Civilization of Lemuria, if only to describe Nan Madol, as it really hasn't been described for most American readers. But the mystery behind Nan Madol is, what is this place? Why was it ever made? And I think that its position, its location, explains exactly what this place was and why it was made. The position of Nan Madol is very unique in the world. It sits right at the center of an area that is known to meteorologists as the birthplace of typhoons. A typhoon is the same thing as a hurricane, just has a different name. And that the position of Nan Madol and its magnetized basalt would be to, in effect, degauss a typhoon before it gets started. What I mean by degauss is to short out a typhoon before it builds up enough strength to become dangerous. When typhoons are building up in a sort of a cyclonic event, they develop a hard core of electrical energy. And that if you could somehow short it out to remove that electrical energy just at the moment that a typhoon is in the state of forming, it would then be reduced to a kind of a rainstorm, and it would lose its cyclonic power. And that, I believe, is what Nan Madol was made to do, was to remove the electronic component or core of a typhoon. Now, I know this is a radical statement to make, but in writing The Lost Civilization of Lemuria, I have only followed the evidence. I did not approach it with any preconceived theories or ideas. I let the evidence form the theories themselves. Now, why would anybody want to get... Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
no, I was curious. There's also a large artificial lake with electric eels that swim out. Why don't you talk about that aspect of the mystery?
Well, part of the aspect of how this anti-typhoon place would have existed, it needed several things, not just this magnetized basalt. As the typhoon would pass over, it would interrelate with the magnetized basalt to create a short. But it needed more than that. It needed also large amounts of conductive minerals. And on Nan Madol were found platinum, which is not native to the Pacific, and also were found special pools that contained large electric eels. Now, why would anybody cultivate electric eels? They don't make very
right.
good eating, and not very good pets either, as a matter of fact.
Certainly, right.
So I postulate that both the existence of large amounts of platinum, which is in itself an incredible mystery, and these holding pens of electric eels all worked together to create this degaussing device, and that's what this enormous device is, this island off the coast of Pohnpei called Nan Madol, that I believe that it was part of an effort to prevent typhoons from building cyclonic force. And that's a very important thing, because if you follow a straight line directly from Nan Madol, about almost 1,000 miles due west of Nan Madol, you have another archaeological mystery in the Philippines. This is called the Banawi Rice Fields. And the Banawi Rice Fields are the largest agricultural estate on Earth. There's never been anything as big as it, not even today. And these agricultural fields were made a minimum of 2,000 years ago, probably much older than that. Archaeologists know that the fields were operative 2,000 years ago. Now, if you are operating an enormous enterprise like this, agricultural enterprise in the Philippines, you're going to be hit by typhoons and your production is going to be disrupted. By placing Nan Madol in the path of these typhoons and degaussing them or taking away their effect, you're able to continue with your food production. And I believe that those two sites in the Philippines, the Banawi rice fields, this enormous agricultural estate, and Nan Madol both work together to provide food for an enormous population of an unknown people many thousands of years ago. And this population could only be explained in the stories that I just mentioned of the lost island that was responsible for other peoples beginning after this island was lost. And I believe that it's remembered in the traditions of peoples around the Pacific and beyond as Lemuria, or
well,
the motherland.
I've been studying pictures of Nan Madol over the last month or so, and it's a very eerie place. It looks like some kind of ghost town that was never inhabited, almost like a utility factory or something, now that you're telling me all of this. And there were no petroglyphs or decorations, were there, or tools or anything like that?
Now, any society which could have created something as advanced and as laid out on such a massive scale as Nan Madol surely would have had art, would have had some at least petroglyphs, some writing, but none of that exists. And the impression one gets from Nan Madol is just exactly like yours. It's like you're stepping into some kind of a power plant or some kind of a utility of some kind. There's no evidence that there was ever a large population ever settled on Nan Madol. So the only people that lived there were the maintenance men to make sure that this thing was working properly.
Now, there were shards of pottery that were found. Do you think that was left behind by another group who came later, or the maintenance men, or what do you make of that?
Oh, I'm sure that long after this place was abandoned, when this disaster took place and had destroyed the motherland, there was no need to maintain this place anymore. And you're absolutely right. Other people came and went. They left pottery. They left food scraps and so on. And that's hardly anything to cause wonder by. The destruction of Lemuria seems to have taken place about 3,600 years ago. We can get into that later, but that appears to be the final time that Nan Madol was, in fact, operated.
I see. Now, let's talk about the creation myths of the people in that region. They talk about Olispa and Oloscaba. I know I pronounced that wrong, but they were apparently tall giants, and I'm wondering if you feel that these were related to maybe the giants, the Anunnaki, who were in other parts of the world, and talk about the myths of the flying dragons as well.
Well, that's very interesting. The traditions of the natives that live on Pohnpei, they do speak about the people that created Nanmadol. And it's interesting that the inhabitants today, the modern inhabitants of Pohnpei, do not claim to have made that place. As a matter of fact, they shun it as an evil place. Very few guides can be found to take you out there. They will not take you out there after sundown. They don't even like to look in its direction. So they do not take credit for it. And they say that Nanmadol was created by twin brothers, who were sorcerers, and that they were regarded as not as giants, not in the sense that they were 20 feet tall or something. They were giants of great magic. The word giant sometimes means to be, sometimes signifies someone who is like a giant of science, that sort of a thing.
Okay.
And that these sorcerers, they claim, were able to build Nanmadol. They came from an island called Kahiki, which was, that's one of the names for it. It had numerous names, and that this island was very far away and succumbed to a great storm and sank. So this is the same story, repeat everywhere. And they claimed that they created Nanmadol through two ways. They floated the stones through the air, and they also had a flying dragon. Now, what I think that we're hearing in these myths are a way that a pre-literate people are trying to explain technology that they are not familiar with. And a flying dragon would be some kind of a device, a machine, a derrick of some kind, who knows how it was powered, that was able to, as it were, float or lift these stones through the air. And I think we are able to encounter the same sort of myth elsewhere in Polynesia. And the great thing about myth is that if you look at it on the surface, on the exterior, it just seems like a fable. But if you look underneath, you see that, in fact, a pre-literate people need a way to preserve important truths or memories. And in order to do this, they create a story, a poem, and you peel away the poetic metaphor and you see the truth beneath. And that's what I try to do in the book.
So could this flying dragon have been a spaceship or... Possibly?
No, I don't believe that. I saw no evidence whatsoever of extraterrestrial intervention in any of this. That doesn't mean that it doesn't exist.
Right.
I'm open to everything. But I think what we're talking about is a great human achievement of a lost people, people that no longer exist, and that they reached a very high level of technology at a time when the rest of the world was not technologically proficient.
Absolutely. Now, let's talk a bit about Edgar Cayce. He did a lot of life readings about Atlantis, but he did also mention Lemuria a bit, didn't he?
It's remarkable. For those of our listeners unfamiliar with Edgar Cayce, he was a very simple, uneducated man who would go into a kind of a deep trance and say things that he never remembered after he came out of the trance. And although he did talk about Atlantis to a much larger degree, he did say some very insightful things about Lemuria. One of the things he said is that Lemuria had achieved great science and spirituality long before Atlantis, and that the Atlanteans, as a matter of fact, derived at least the beginnings of their own culture from the Lemurian beginnings. So Lemuria, or Mu, as it's sometimes referred to, seems underscored by Cayce, and the evidence seems to confirm him that is the real origin place of human civilization, that civilization began, incredibly enough, in the Pacific and spread to other parts of the world. But we're talking about a civilization that is so old, so lost to history and time, that modern archaeologists have a long way to go before they catch up and finally realize that this, in fact, is where man made the step from barbarism to civilization, was in the Pacific on this collection of islands, a string of archipelagos that spanned the Pacific. And we're talking about a time before the last ice age. It's mind-blowing. It's mind-boggling. But the evidence, I think, is clear.
on Odyssey. Sorry about the technical glitch, but we are going to continue with our interview. You were talking a bit more about Lemuria and the legends. Go ahead, Frank.
I was just saying that I think that these legends that we see all across the Pacific are repeated by peoples who were separated by thousands of miles, who shared no linguistic or cultural common denominators, and yet they all spoke about origins on this lost island, this series of islands, actually, from which their own ancestors arrived. And I think that that's what we're talking about. But the greatness of Lemuria, the importance of it, is how it speaks to us today. And if you want, we can go into that.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about Yanaguni, which is the last island off of the tail of islands in Japan and has been submerged for thousands of years. But something fascinating was found there in 1985, an incredible series of structures. Why don't you talk about that finding and what it may mean for Lemuria?
Well, it means everything for Lemuria. Yanaguni is a very small island off the coast, actually, of Taiwan, not too far from Taiwan. It's the most extreme southern island in the chain of Japanese islands. And in 1985, a scuba diving instructor, by accident, happened to find off the coast of Yanaguni, sitting in 100 feet of water, a castle, referred to as a citadel.
Yeah.
And he couldn't believe his eyes, and when he went back to the island of Yanaguni, he telegraphed his friends in Japan. That started a kind of an avalanche of tourists out to that area to see this structure. And over time, the University of the Ryukyus, which is the series of islands off the coast of Japan, they commissioned Professor Masakai Kimura to investigate this underwater structure. Professor Masakai Kimura is a world-class geologist, and he and his class, his students, studied this structure off the coast of Yanaguni for over 3 years. There was a lot of talk that this was just a natural formation that resembled a building, but there were some people who thought that it couldn't possibly be formed by natural causes and that it looked artificial. So it was up to Professor Kimura to determine if it in fact was man-made or natural. And after over 3 years, he went out in public and in front of all of his colleagues and affirmed that there is no doubt that this was a man-made structure, that it is the oldest known building of its kind on Earth, and that it was made at a time when the sea level was 100 feet lower than it is today. That means that this structure, which does kind of resemble a castle or a citadel, had to be made before 10 or 12,000 years ago, when we're told that the oldest structures of this kind were made about 5,000 years ago in ancient Egypt and in Mesopotamia. In fact, someone in the Pacific off the coast of this small island, Yanaguni, was already building a structure that has gates, which are remarkably similar to the so-called Gateway of the Sun in Peru. It has a stairway. It has a loop, what they call a loop road, that completely circles the structure. It has a plaza. Professor Kimura was able to actually find some of the tools that went into the construction of this structure. It's amazing. And he was able to match up the tools with the tool marks, and it was that discovery which really convinced his colleagues. Yeah. When he first came out and said, no, this is definitely a man-made structure, most of his colleagues, of course, completely rebelled at the idea. It was impossible. But he has now convinced the majority, if not all, of his fellow geologists and archaeologists in Japan and many other parts of the world. There have only been really about 8 professional university-trained academics that have visited Yanaguni. One reason it is because it is patrolled by schools of hammerhead sharks, which makes study a little bit nervous down there.
Absolutely.
So not too many professors are willing to do that. But those that have gone down, there's been 8 so far as I know, probably more since, but 8. And of those 8, 6 have, from different parts of the world, 6 have said that it's definitely a man-made structure. One of them, the American, is not sure. He sort of waffled one
Dr.
way or the
Schock?
Other. Professor Schock.
Right.
And, of course, a German would have to say, no, it's completely natural and artificial, and not artificial. But he's the only one.
Well, Graham Hancock believes it's artificial, correct? He's the kind of the leading researcher in this field.
Well, I wouldn't call it, I don't think he referred to himself as the leading researcher, but certainly an important researcher.
Important, sure.
And he was there and collected a lot of tremendous information about it. And absolutely, I think that his work on these sunken structures is the most important thing he's ever done, personally, and I'm very grateful that he's been able to publish Waterworld. I believe that was the name of the...
Underworld, right.
Underworld, I'm sorry. Underworld, yeah.
And people can go online and see pictures of Yanaguni also as well. Now, do you believe this was a ceremonial site, or was it a living structure? What do you think the evidence indicates?
Professor Kimura said that this was a structure that was terraformed or modified from a natural formation, kind of like the Great Sphinx in a way, where there was some unusual formation which was then modified by human hands. I do not believe that, and Professor Kimura, I think, affirms that this was not a live-in structure, that it was a ceremonial building of some kind. I was able to find out two really interesting things about the structure at Yanaguni, and that is its orientation is to the rising sun. And it was also built precisely on a very important line that goes around the Earth called the Tropic of Tropic of Capricorn.
Sure.
And the Tropic of Capricorn is the pathway of the sun, which shifts over time. And if you, right now, the Yanaguni structure does not sit in the Tropic of Capricorn, but 10,000 years ago it did, because the sun changes its position slowly over time. And that coincides with what Professor Kimura believes is the date for the building of this structure, which is about 10,000 years ago when sea levels were lower to accommodate the construction or the terraforming of this structure. So I believe it was ceremonial, that it had to do with a sun worship that fits in immensely well with what we know about Lemurian religion, which was the worship of light. Not the sun per se, that was a symbol, but it was the worship of light or enlightenment. And this was one of the great contributions that the Lemurians made, especially to Tibetan Buddhism. The Tibetan Buddhists are quite aware of their origins in the Pacific. Their religion was brought to them by a man who belonged to a people they referred to as the Mu. This is in Tibetan traditions. And I believe that the structure at Yanaguni is hard evidence, inescapable evidence to show that this is the remnant, one of the numerous remnants of this lost civilization. However, the structure at Yanaguni is not unique, in that there are other fabulous structures found underwater and on land all throughout the Pacific, which attest to the former existence of this great civilization.
It's very powerful evidence. Okay, why don't we continue our tour of the Pacific? Let's go to a remote island called Easter Island in the middle of the Pacific and talk about the giant statues. And do you believe that this was the lost tail end of Lemuria? Or what is your take on Easter Island?
Easter Island was an important part of the whole Lemurian story. The Easter Islanders themselves talk about their... the creation of their civilization in the ancient past. And I should tell our listeners that Easter Island is almost as remote as Pohnpei or Nan Madol.
Yes.
It's something like 2,300 miles off the coast of Peru, South America. And this small, teeny island is the only island in the entire vast Pacific realm that had a level of civilization absolutely unique to itself, in that not only that they made these immense statues and these incredible platforms that they were placed on, but they also had a written language called Rango Rango, which just literally means sound, sound, sound.
Right.
And
there were pictures.
It was an ideographic written language which is no longer able to be understood because when the early Christians in the 19th century landed at Easter Island, the Easter Islanders were still using these Rango Rango boards. These were wooden boards in which this beautiful script was inscribed on both sides, and that the Christians and their missionaries, in their zeal to convert the people of Easter Island, condemned much of their culture as demonology, and collected these Rango Rango boards and burned almost all of them. There's only about maybe two or three that exist today, and not enough in order to affect the translation, unfortunately. So
but
that
you,
is all lost.
But you found a crucial key to the puzzle in that there's an ancient city in India called Mohenjo-Daro where some of this Rango-Rango script is also used.
That is an incredible discovery that was made in the early 20th century by a brilliant Hungarian linguist whose name I have difficulty pronouncing, Hevesany, I believe is his name. And he was able to show that this so-called unique writing system found only on Easter Island also is found on the exact opposite side of the world, on the other side of the world, in India.
Yes.
And only associated with a civilization which no longer exists, which was the first civilization in India. This is known as the Indus Valley Civilization. People who rose very high in the cultural arts were devoted to ritual bathing and created structures that were not that far different, at least fundamentally similar to some of the structures we see at Nan Madol, these square, canal-like structures. And that this writing, Rango Rango, which is found only on Easter Island, outside of Easter Island, it's only found on the other side of the world in Mohenjo-Daro, which is in the Indus Valley. Now, how can we possibly explain the connection between these two absolutely remote civilizations? They were not contemporary. The Indus Valley flourished about 5,000 more or less years ago,
right,
and became extinct around 1800 B.C. And at Easter Island, all the archaeology shows that Easter Island really only began about 400 A.D., and collapsed in modern times in the 19th century. So how can we explain the appearance of these two scripts that are virtually identical, mirror images of themselves,
yes,
on opposite parts of the world? And in my book, I think that the only explanation is that both Easter Island, the Easter Islanders and the ancient inhabitants of Mohenjo-Daro in India, were recipients independently of the motherland, whose culture bearers went east and west and left remnants of their written language in Easter Island and in the Indus Valley. I don't see any other possible explanation for how you can have a coincidental, well, it's not coincidental, a relationship between two complex writing systems that are so close without seeing some middleman. I think that is one of the contributions that the Lemurians made to the origins of civilization.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, talk to me about all of these islands statues scattered all across the island. There's about 800 of these giant, large statues. It was a massive project, and it was suddenly stopped because it looked like some of them are half-finished. Why do you think they were built, and why do you think they stopped this massive project?
These statues are referred to as Moai, M-O-A-I, and the technology that went into them defies all archaeological explanations. Some of them are very small. It could only be about 2 feet high. And others, the largest known one is something like 67 feet high, would have weighed far more than any of the largest stones within the Great Pyramid. And yet these massive Moai statues were quarried from the living rock and then moved to the periphery of Easter Island. There's a great quarry in the center of, not the center, towards the middle of Easter Island, and it's from this quarry that all these massive statues were made. All the statues are identical. They're all the same. They all portray the same person. And that person is their flood hero. This flood hero was the bearer of high culture from Mare Renga, and from these are different names for the same Lemurian motherland. So they're representing the same culture hero over and over again, and he is always brought to these statues are always brought on these massive platforms at the edge of Easter Island. And they are facing inward. They're not facing out to sea. So it's as though the statues are moving from the sea, but they are not decorative. They are not religious. They are part of this same technology that we find at Nan Madol. The position of Easter Island is at an incredibly crucial juncture between two massive tectonic plates. which cause and generate massive sea quakes and result in tsunamis and massive earthquakes all throughout Polynesia and into South America. This is called the Cocos Plate and the Eastern Pacific Rise. These two plates are responsible for major earthquake activity. I believe, and I don't have time to discuss it in length here, so it sounds utterly fantastic and unbelievable, mm-hmm. but I believe that these statues were part of the same technology which was to change seismic energy to disperse it into electrical energy. I think that Easter Island was chosen specifically for its location to ameliorate the worst effects of earthquakes. We're dealing with a civilization which was very much in tune with natural law and natural forces. And from this attunement, they developed a technology which was totally different than ours, and in some regards completely different. Whereas we're struggling with the effects of tsunamis and hurricanes, I think these people knew how to work with these forces, that they developed a fundamentally simple technology through generations of close observation of natural phenomena, and were able to work in harmony with these forces and to ameliorate them. The purpose of Nan Madol was to prevent typhoons. The purpose of Easter Island was to ameliorate the worst effects of earthquake violence, and I believe that that's why those statues were made. They are stylized versions of another technological effort to prevent natural disasters, and it was eventually their inability to control those natural disasters that overwhelmed their homeland. And we're facing the same thing today. Mm-hmm. With our ecological decline, we are struggling now, as Johnny Come Lately's, to try to ameliorate the worst effects of global warming, which are responsible for things like the worst tornado ever experienced in the United States not too long ago, when it completely flattened that town, things like Hurricane Katrina. These are things that overwhelmed, I believe, Lemuria in the end, and if we're not careful, they're going to overwhelm us as well. That's
right.
The great legacy, I think, of Lemuria, that these were people who worked with nature and were able to survive for a very long time.
History repeats itself. Now, let's go a bit west. Now, there are a few stone foundation walls and circular buildings that have an interesting type of construction. It's multi-angled pieces of stone. And there's another place in Peru that has this same type of building. Why don't you talk about this subject?
There's the capital of the Inca Empire was a place called Cusco. And it means navel of the world. And at the very center of Cusco, at the very center of this navel, was a place called the Coricanca, which means the enclosure of gold. And inside the Coricanca was a stone. They referred to as the Papacaya, which means the firestone or the stone of destiny. And I think that what we're seeing here is the transference of this technology from this lost civilization into the later day Incas, because Cusco itself sits at a confluence of fault lines. As everybody knows, the Andes are a very earthquake prone place to be, and yet they raised a great civilization there. And you see the same sort of stonework involved at Cusco and in other major Inca sites like Machu Picchu that you find in other places in the world, like in Japan, and the palace made for the emperor in Tokyo. And the stonework is so fascinating because there's no mortar used, and the stones are so cut and balanced against each other that they move. They move in harmony with the earth itself. There was an earthquake that took place in the 1980s in which the stones of Machu Picchu were observed to slide back and forth on each other during the process of the earthquake, the progress of the earthquake. And then when the earthquake stopped, the stones slid back into their original positions. And this, I think, is an example of the Lemurian style. The Lemurian style was always to live very closely in harmony with nature. And in my book, I've tried to point out that the Lemurians included this not only in their buildings and in their science, but in their religion as well, their mysticism. And they applied it to their society. In other words, they lived close to natural law. They observe natural law and live close to it because they believe that natural law was the physical manifestation of God. And therefore, if you abide by natural law, you're abiding by God.
Right. Now, let's talk about a very uninhabitable part of South America, because I think your theory is that the Lemurians also came to this very high plateau, 13,000 feet high. Now, there's two cities, and they're very different. One is called Puma Punku, and it's in ruins. And then there's this beautiful kind of courtyard and wonderful area that's advanced and still pretty much, in good shape, and that's Tiwanaku. So why don't you talk about those two cities high up in Peru?
Very remarkable places. Like you say, they're 13,000 feet high. It's impossible to live there today. Even today,
it's barren.
The area around is agriculturally devoid. It
yes.
is a desert. Not the only thing that will grow there, not even cactus will grow there probably, just scrub vegetation. And yet we have two huge cities that flourished in the ancient past. One is called Tiwanaku, which, by the way, came from the name Tiwanaku is a corruption of a Aymara Indian word, which means stone in the middle of the sea. This society, this Lemurian society, placed so much emphasis on these crystals, these large stones which they had crafted to serve this technological purpose, and I think that some of these stones went with their missionaries to places like Tiwanaku. Now, Tiwanaku, now 13,000 feet high, obviously a city, a ceremonial city, that would have been home to many thousands of people, was also close to a lake, the highest lake in the world, which is Lake Titicaca.
Sure.
We know for a fact that when you go to Tiwanaku, you can see the remains of some of the structures at Tiwanaku sticking out of the ground, archways and so forth that are completely at ground level now. And that's because all of the deposition from the retreat of this lake, which used to be right at the foot of Tiwanaku, is now 12 miles away, retreated. Some incredible catastrophe made it impossible for anyone to live at Tiwanaku. Not too far from Tiwanaku are the remains of another gigantic city, only it's in far worse shape. It's called Pumapanku. And what's remarkable about Pumapanku and Tiwanaku is that so much of it is buried underground, and it was buried underground by natural deposition. In other words, when Lake Titicaca was lapping the extremities of Pumapanku and Tiwanaku, something shifted it suddenly 12 miles away. I should preface what I'm going to say is that the world, the history as we know it, the conventional history of the world as we've been brought up to believe, is changing very rapidly.
Yes.
And that history will not be taught the same way 20 or 50 years as it is taught to us today.
Absolutely.
And one of the what's making it difficult too for me is here on the radio, I don't have a chance to be able to explain the reasons why I have these statements, but it would appear that the Andes Mountains were thrust up not over the course of many thousands or millions of years, but that they arose in sudden spurts, and that the city of Tiwanaku and Pumapanku were at one time built at sea level, and that an enormous catastrophe took place, which I believe was the destruction of Lemuria, which forced many earth changes that seem to us utterly astounding and incomprehensible today. And part of that was the sudden upthrust of the Andes Mountains in a very short time. We're talking in only a few years from sea level to 13,000 feet. Now, it used to be thought that mountain progress was really a very slow affair, but during an earthquake in 1992 in the San Gabriel Mountains of Southern California, there was an earthquake measuring device, and it found out that during a major earthquake that took place in the San Gabriel Mountains, but not a catastrophic earthquake, but I think something like about maybe 6 or 7 on the Richter scale, that parts of the San Gabriel Mountains rose 1.5 feet in a few moments, in a few minutes.
Hmm.
And until then, it was thought, well, it was called ontogeny. Ontogeny is mountain building. It's a very slow process, and it is, generally speaking, but there are moments of geologic violence that can transform mountain building from the event of a few thousand or million years into the event of a few minutes. And that's now accepted. And I believe that's what happened at the Andes Mountains, that Pumapunku and Tiahuanaco were thrust up by this enormous catastrophe. And that Pumapunku is the older of these cities and was...
sustained more damage.
Far more damage. There's not much to see at Pumapunku today. Pumapunku is an astounding place because you have these huge, gigantic walls and stones beautifully carved and fitted, incredibly complex.
As if by machinery, right?
By machinery. Could only have been machined. They're like kind of
are
like...
Are there grooves? How do you know that?
Pardon me?
Are there grooves in the stone?
There are not only grooves. The grooves are of such complexity that it's beyond the most skilled craftsmen to have made. The blocks at Pumapunku fit into each other like Lego, like a Lego set.
Perfect.
And only the difficulty is, in order to lift these things up and so they would slide into each other, would take some effort, because some of these stones were efforts of 20 and 30 tons, and the manpower involved in such a thing, you cannot use at 13,000 feet. You fall over. I've visited there. I've been there myself.
I hardly can tell you,
just walking there is an effort. Trying to lift heavy masonry is completely out of the question.
Now, the stone quarry is 50 miles away. How did they lift it and carry it that far?
I don't know. All I can tell you is that they had...
The flying dragons?
Well, yeah, a flying dragon. I believe that they possess the technology. What we see in these structures are just the remnants, just the shadows of the technology that went into... Well, look at the Sears Tower in Chicago. The Sears Tower stands there, but all the derricks and the construction material has all been long done away with. It's no longer necessary. And I think that the same thing happened in the ancient past, that when their technology was no longer needed to complete the building, because the building is finished, then they went on to some other place. So things like that are going to not stand the test of time. So it's very hard for us to understand what kind of technology they had.
And we're winding down, maybe 10 more minutes. Just to tie it into Easter Island, don't some of the statues at Tiahuanaco appear similar to those of Easter Island, indicating it may have been the same people?
Right. There's a real strong connection, especially Tiahuanaco. At Tiahuanaco, there's the Gateway of the Sun. And if you study the iconography now with the internet and so on, you can get real close views of it. Study the iconography at the top of the Gateway of the Sun at Tiahuanaco, high in the Andes Mountains, and then compare with the iconography of Easter Island, especially a figure in Easter Island known as Makemake, or the Birdman. And it's the same figure.
Right.
So it's, there's no doubt that, as a matter of fact, that language, written language we were talking about, Rongo Rongo, which is only found at Easter Island and Mohenjo-Daro, there are traces of it that are also found at Tiahuanaco.
Uh-huh.
And one more place, which is in Panama.
Yeah.
In Panama, the level of culture there is not particularly high, and yet they have remnants of this written language. So it's fascinating stuff.
Now, the primitive people of South America believed in this god that they called Quetzalcoatl, and he was something like a birdman. Could this have been Quetzalcoatl they're referring to at Easter Island and Tiahuanaco?
I think we are all talking about the same culture bearer, a class of culture bearers, and that naturally people that belong to a different society, a different language and so on, are going to have different names for the same one. So the ancient Mexicans would refer to him as Quetzalcoatl or Kukulcan, the plumed serpent. Then the people in the Inca lands would refer to him as Kuntiki Viracocha. Then these Makemake and Easter Island. These are all just different names for the same culture-bearing class, I think. And they probably were referred to as birdmen, maybe because of their headgear, or because they're able to travel at great speed across the sea. Who knows? These are poetic metaphors for meanings that we are having very difficult time trying to establish with any certainty.
Absolutely. Now, a couple more curiosities. There's one island in the South Pacific that actually has pine trees, which is completely unusual, and 400 cement cylinders. Why don't you talk about Cunha and what this all means?
Well, this is part of this lost technology. I think that if you're able to go to that place, it's absolutely astounding. Cunha is this another incredibly obscure and remote island, very small. It's uninhabited, it's so small. And these great pine trees, these enormous pine trees are growing there. It makes absolutely no sense at all. It's the only island in the entire Pacific that has these huge pine trees. And why are they growing there? And it looks as though they were planted there deliberately thousands of years ago in order to keep the island from the sands and the island from being disturbed too much. There was a French archaeologist who in the 1960s, early 1970s, found a number of mounds on the Island of Pines. It's referred to, Cunha is known as the Isle of Pines. And he dug into these mounds. They look like little anthills. Well, some of them aren't quite so little. They're maybe only about 5 feet high, but they can spread out like 50 feet across. And he found at the center of these mounds, these ant-like mounds, cement cylinders. And he found not just one or two, but he found hundreds of these cement cylinders.
Yes.
They're man-made. There's never been any habitation on this island. Then he had the cement cylinders dated. They were very easily carbon dated because there was a lot of organic material that went into the making of these cement cylinders. And it turned out that these cement cylinders were at least 4,000, between 4,000 and 7,000 years old.
Wow.
And here was somebody who created a technology we're not familiar with. I cannot understand why these things were made, but I believe it was part of the natural electrical phenomena that this Lemurian people were dealing with. But you can go to these places today. None of this is made up or the truth has been stretched at all, and
no.
I try to provide as much solid documentation in my book for all of these statements, but the Isle of Pines has hundreds of these cement cylinders. It's amazing that some scientists are absolutely unwilling to accept that such a place exists, and so they say, well, these cement cylinders were made by birds.
Oh, Lord. Oh, please. Talk
so,
about a conspiracy theory.
That's pretty good.
But it's clearly some sort of, like I said before, some kind of lost utility area, or
mm-hmm.
like stumbling on some kind of utility plant that's been abandoned. It's something like that.
That's right, it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that what this technology was geared at, literally controlling the weather and controlling natural forces, seismic under the earth and meteorological over the earth.
And the last topic I want to touch on tonight, I want to end up with Hawaii. You uncovered, actually, some Hawaiian chief from the 1800s who had an actual map with Lemuria on it. Why don't you talk about that?
Well, I didn't uncover that. There's a great guy who wrote a book before mine on Lemuria. It's called In Search of Lemuria by Mark Willis.
Okay.
And it's an excellent book. I really recommend everybody to get that one if they're interested in Lemuria, too. And, yeah, there was a Hawaiian chief who actually had a map of Lemuria that explained the whole thing, and it was actually in the Bishop Museum in Hawaii, and as far as I know, it's still there. I'm not sure if it is, but it is still there. Yeah, the map is still there, and you can actually, it definitely is still there, and you can go and see it yourself. And this map was created at a time when one of the last Hawaiian kings wanted to be able to preserve all of the oral traditions. Of course, the Hawaiians didn't write things down or have maps and all that, but after they became educated, they began to chronicle all of their oral traditions, and among their oral traditions was the story of how their ancestors came from Lemuria and established themselves in Hawaii. All these things I'm telling you, by the way, are absolutely opposed hysterically by mainstream archaeologists.
Of course.
Who believe that this is all a fantasy and completely made up, but are unable to explain any of these mysteries that we've been talking about.
No, absolutely. Now, you believe some of the Lemurians were kind of driven from Hawaii. A lot of people don't know this, and I was shocked that there's two kind of remote, mysterious little islands 100 miles away from Hawaii with some strange structures on them. Why don't we end with that? Talk about those two islands.
Well, these two islands, one of them is referred to as the Serrated Edge, and these two islands are completely uninhabitable. They're dangerous to land at even today. Very few people go. The other one is called Nihoa. And these two little dots in the Pacific, which are very hard to land at because the seas are so rough and there's no proper landing there. And yet on these two little islands, there are the remains of major structures, that there was a habitation that was obtained on these two little islands in the ancient past. And this fits in with the stories that the Polynesians of Hawaii tell. and that is that when the Polynesians arrived on the Hawaiian Islands, the Hawaiian Islands were already inhabited by people they refer to as the Mu, strangely enough, also known as the Menehune. But they were described as a Caucasian people with light hair, yellow hair, and that the two peoples didn't war, but they were distant from each other. And as more Polynesians came into Hawaii, the Menehune or the Mu, they removed themselves further and further away until they wound up at these two little islands, one called the Serrated Edge and the other one's Nahoa. And that is the Hawaiian story. And as it was considered, oh, that's just legend, that's just myth, you know. Until archaeologists in the 19th century were finally able to land on Nahoa and Serrated Edge.
And they couldn't even land on it. It was that difficult.
It was extremely, it still is, it's very difficult. I think the only way you can really go the day is by helicopter.
Wow.
And that's rough, too, because it's extremely gusty, so very few people go there. But there are remains of a really sophisticated, what they call cyclopean blocks, or large-sized blocks that were cut and positioned very beautifully. All in the Menehune style. There's something called the Menehune Ditch, which is still seen by tourists today. And it's far more than a ditch, let me tell you. It's a massive canal, uses huge, beautifully cut stones of the kind that we see in Peru. And that's certainly not part of the Polynesian tradition, but very much part of the story related to the Mu, or the Menehune. And in The Lost Civilization of Lemuria, I tried to trace these people from their greatness to their decline and to the great effects of their civilization on our times today.
Absolutely. Well, I've been speaking with Frank Joseph, and he is the author of The Lost Civilization of Lemuria. How can they get this book and your other books?
Well, the best way is just to go to Amazon.com.
Okay.
The Lost Civilization of Lemuria is in many Borders and Barnes & Noble stores. If it's not in the Barnes & Noble nearest you, can just ask for customer service and they get it for you immediately. They can get it for you like in 24 hours. But if you don't want to go that route, certainly The Lost Civilization of Lemuria is available from Amazon.com.
Okay, Frank Joseph, you're a fascinating guest. I would love to have you back on again to talk about your other book.
Well,
let's
do that.
So much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So tonight was kind of a funny show, you know. I just said, damn the torpedoes. I don't care what kind of technical problems we have. This is a great interview, and nothing's going to throw me off the air, nothing. You know, I'm just going to keep going and going. And we didn't get to phone calls tonight. I actually didn't want to throw open the lines because of the technical problems. But Odyssey, I've kind of, you know, made a decision this week. I'm going to fly solo. I love doing radio. I've just always felt this is my destiny. I'm totally in the zone. This is what I love to do. I love bringing you all of these fascinating guests. All of my shows are on the permanent archives at Odyssey. And I have DVDs on these ancient mysteries as well, and I do touch on Yanaguni and the Japanese monuments. So check out my two DVDs at the Odyssey Radio Network website, or go to fountainsofyouth.net. That's my personal website. It's fountainsofyouth.net. So just to let you know, I see David Icke's coming back on the air next week, and he's absolutely, I think, the most riveting, fascinating speaker in the world. And we are trying to get him on the show. So let's all just manifest that and just put it out there that we want David Icke to come to the network. And that would be wonderful. But he had a great interview last week, and he's coming on again this week on News for the Soul. So absolutely. Okay, so we're winding up now. Like I said, Odyssey is going to come to you every Monday at 8 p.m. I'm going to bring you the most fascinating books and authors, and we're going to talk about mystical and metaphysical topics, and we're just going to dig through every tunnel, and I'm going to take you to the ends of the earth like I did tonight. So anyway, it's very exciting to be with you. Please find out more about me at the Odyssey if you click on that box on the main website and check out my DVDs. And I will see you next Monday at 8. We're going to talk about crystal elixirs and Edgar Cayce and the lost continent of Atlantis. Thank you for joining me tonight. Good night.